So the title of my talk is not antigenic evolution, as you see here. It's the, that was a tentative title, and this conference has been so interesting and so fascinating, and has occupied so much of my time that I couldn't decide what to talk on, and I didn't have much time to think about it while I was here. So anyways, I decided to talk on about a project that I've been working on off and on for a while, and that has to do with the maintenance of cooperation as opposed to the evolution of cooperation, and I hope to show you the difference between those two, and the relationship between the maintenance of cooperation and mutation rate. Okay, so first off, of course, is the advertisement slide. Cooperation is everywhere, right? Bees and microbes and meerkats and people, right? So, and here's one of my favorite movies of cooperation. This is Dictyostelium, and these are little single-celled organisms that live half of their lives as individualists in isolated, going around finding food by themselves. And when times get tough, they come together and they cooperate and they actually form a multicellular organism that they call a slug, and it moves around. It's really, it's amazing. And of course, not to be anthropocentric or anything, but cooperation's masterpiece is the human being, right? Of course. And basically, it's multicellularity in general. Okay, so how did we get multicellularity? What are its evolutionary origins, and what's responsible for its evolutionary maintenance? This talk is more about the latter than the former. So let's start about 1 billion years ago. We had lots of little individualists floating around in a primordial soup. And you fast forward about 500 million years, and we have this. Okay, we have multicellular organisms. So, what happened in between? How did you go from this primordial soup to the multicellular organisms? And the evolution of multicellularity essentially boils down to a covenant between somatic cells and germline cells, right? And the problem is that the somatic cells make an enormous evolutionary sacrifice, right? Because they don't get to pass on their genes to future generations, right? They're just the guardians of the germline cells who do get to pass their genes on to future generations. So how do you get somatic cells? That's the real evolutionary question. Because somatic cells are paying a huge evolutionary cost to play their role as the guardians, right, of the germline cells. And most of our bodies are somatic cells, right? So it's the overwhelming majority of multicellular organisms are somatic cells, and they're paying this enormous evolutionary cost. And so this covenant is essentially enforced by what are called tumor suppressor genes, okay, things that stop the somatic cells from growing too much or using too much resource or allowing the body size to get too large, or, you know, and this is an organism that might be similar to some of the first multicellular organisms. Okay, so.
Is it somatic cells, blood vessels?
What's that?
It has somatic cells, blood vessels?
Yeah, yeah. So, and what happens when this covenant is broken? That's when you get cancer. Okay, the somatic cells. You have a somatic cell in that says, "I'm not going to take this repression anymore, and I'm going to grow as fast as I want. And so, of course, they do this genetically, right? It's a mutation that then allows them to grow freely and essentially break this covenant between soma and germline. Okay?
But so in animals, sure, it's breaking the covenant that cancer cells don't have any opportunity to help.
Right.
Cancer.
Yeah, good. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but so it's partially breaking the covenant because
it's not succeeding and getting what, you know, would actually increase their evolutionary potential.
Right.
It's a short-term gain.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Unless it's cancer in Tasmanian devil, which can be transmitted actually.
So the species.
So right.
But they don't care.
Right. Yeah. So okay. So So how did multicellularity and tumor suppressor genes originate? And the answer to that is the evolution of cooperation. And what I'm more interested in is how does multicellularity persist, and how do tumor suppressor genes stay intact? And the answer to that is the maintenance of cooperation. Okay. Okay, so the evolution of cooperation is a really hot topic, and it's really hard to make any sort of headway in that area that hasn't already been done. The number of papers is in the thousands, and everything that I've seen uses the standard population genetics approach of what you do is you essentially start with a single mutant, cooperating mutant, in a population of defectors, and then you ask, what's the probability of fixation of that single cooperating mutant in the population? And it works, this approach works for the evolution of cooperation. It doesn't necessarily work for the maintenance of cooperation. Okay, so I've only come across three papers that kind of tangentially treat the problem of cooperation maintenance, and in these papers, it's assumed to be equivalent to the problem of the evolution of cooperation, and it turns out this is wrong. This is the wrong approach. You can't use the standard population genetics approach, and I'll show you why in a minute. I've already mentioned this last point here. Okay, so what the math tells us. This is essentially the way you set up a simple cooperation game. You have cooperators that have cooperation in these games is a heritable trait. Okay, so you pass these traits on to your offspring. Cooperators increase their neighbor's fitness by a factor 1 plus epsilon, okay? That's the first rule of this game. The second rule is that cheaters do not increase their neighbor's fitness, but they themselves gain a fitness advantage of 1 plus beta, okay? So there's an intrinsic advantage of being a cheater. And cheaters also receive help from cooperating neighbors, okay? So cooperators cooperate indiscriminately. So for only two players, this translates to the game of Prisoner's Dilemma when this condition holds here. Okay, so if you take these rules and set up a mean field model, this is what it might look like. So here the X's are the cooperators, the Y's are the cheaters. You have logistic growth. This is your rate for the rate of increase for the cooperators, rate of increase for the cheaters, and this is just mutation back and forth between cooperating and cheating strategies. Okay, and your rate of increase in the cooperators is just epsilon times X. Okay, so all the X's are helping you, right? Your rate of increase if you're a cheater is beta plus epsilon times X, because you have this intrinsic advantage beta. okay? And if you solve this, you get, it's easy to solve. You have some stable critical points. If mutation rate approaches zero, then the frequency of cheaters is one and cooperators is zero in equilibrium, okay? If it's not zero, if it's significant, then it's not, then the frequency of cheaters is mu over beta, and the frequency of cooperators is the complement of that. So, I'm sorry, this is cheaters. This is cheaters and this is cooperators, okay? So, the moral of the story here is that cooperators win in a mean field model. Okay, cooperators take over because this thing is small here, right? So.
If that's small, then cheaters take over.
Cheaters, what did I say?
You said the cooperators take over.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So the problem is the mutation rate, cheaters take over.
Yes, thank you. Cheaters take over. The moral of the story is that cheaters win, hands down, in a mean field model. And the tragedy of the commons is what is essentially the name that this has been given. And this is essentially to reflect the fact that the mean fitness of the population, so there should be a bar here, this is mean fitness of the population, at time zero starts out at this, because so you start out with everybody being a cooperator, and as time goes to infinity, it's this 1 plus beta, and epsilon is greater than beta. So essentially what happens is the mean fitness decreases by natural selection, and that's the prisoner's dilemma, or the tragedy of the commons. Okay, so the Nash equilibrium is one in which cheaters prevail. Okay, so this is what the data tell us. So there have been a number of experiments of using social bacteria in the lab, and in which it has been shown that cheater mutations, first of all, are extremely common. It's really easy to get a cheater mutation. And second of all, cheaters have an immediate selective advantage with respect to the cooperating wild type, and this has also been shown in laboratory populations. Okay, and sometimes there's one example that I know of in which the cheaters take over and actually cause the population to go extinct, and that's in a mixo population of Mixococcus. So I guess I should go very, very quickly through the ways in which you can get you have cooperation in the lab. So there are in biofilms, the bacteria secrete this sticky stuff that holds everybody together. And cheaters arise that use that sticky stuff that holds everybody together, but they don't themselves produce it. And by not producing it, they can then invest more energy and time into reproduction. And so they have an intrinsic advantage of being a cheater. So quorum sensing is another example. You have bacteria that send out signals, quorum sensing, quorum signals, and cheaters are variants that don't send out the signals, but they take advantage of the signaling of the other send out. Okay, virulence factors is another example where some have it and the cheaters just use that. There are a number of different ways you can get cheating. And if you do a simple gene counting argument, you can see that the potential for cheating is immense. So in human cells, I'm going to screw the numbers up here, but the number of genes that are responsible for essentially multicellular organization type functions is about 30,000. Okay, I'm pretty sure it's something like that. So it's an enormous target, right? There's an enormous target, and any mutant in those 30,000 genes is potentially a cheater mutant. Okay, so you can see that there's a lot of potential for cheating, and it's been shown in the laboratory that cheating happens all the time, and it takes over populations. And so the moral of this story is that what the math and the data are both telling us is that cooperation should not exist. Okay, the math says you do a mean field model, cheaters win hands down. Okay, the data are telling us that cheaters are winning in laboratory populations, and that there's a lot of potential for cheater mutants to arise. So how does cooperation persist?
But the data, I mean, is that really the message of the data? I mean, the cheaters exist, these mutants arise, but they're not taking over everything, so the operators are still there.
The example that I mentioned is an extreme example where the cheaters took over and caused the population to go extinct. And you're right that in most cases, cheaters don't take over the population entirely, but they rise to high frequency in the population pretty readily in what I've seen. And I'm by no means an expert on this on this literature.
But question, like for the biofilm example, it could be division of labor. Like I need a certain amount of polymer to be sticky, so I don't need every single individual. It could be cooperation. I mean, if not everybody secretes polymers, they could do something else.
Well, right. You could look at it in the reverse way and say that the suckers who are actually producing this sticky stuff are altruists, right? You could say that their behavior is altruistic, but the guys who are not producing it are in my terminology are cheaters. Okay, it's just it might come down to semantics.
It seems to me that for what you say,
I don't know if I agree with this terminology.
Yeah.
Well, I think I need a certain amount of polymer to be made for the
who's I?
To make,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. The question is: are the ones that don't make polymers clones of the ones that do, or are they? Is that a mutation?
That's the question. Yeah. It's right. Yeah.
If they're clones, then what you say is right.
Right.
That is another point.
If they're isogenic, so if they're, yeah.
That the frequency of these are higher in these lab experiments than you find them in nature, right? So if you pull out a dictyostelium or
yes.
I mean, so that's part of what you're saying, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And these controlled experiments where you take away other things.
Right, right. Well, these so the experiments that I'm talking about are well mixed populations. So in that sense, they're not, as far as I understand, they're not really reflective of what goes on in nature, because most of what goes on in nature is on surfaces and that sort of thing. So, and that's going to be the key to this whole talk here. So. So how does cooperation persist? So here's the big mystery summed up. So cheater mutations are very common. They have an immediate selective advantage. In the mean field model, they displace cooperators deterministically. In well-mixed laboratory populations, cheaters displace cooperators. So how does cooperation persist? And there are two solutions to this mystery. The first is enforcement, right? Policing. You get police in the population that if they find a cheater, they punish it or kill it, and that's one way to maintain cooperation, right? But it's costly and it's complicated. It's a very sophisticated solution to this problem. The cheap and easy solution, the non-sophisticated solution, is just simple population structure. So, and that's what's going to be modeled here. I'm going to model population structure. And this is how it's modeled on a grid. So I did this on different kinds of networks. I did it on random networks, scale-free networks, and different kinds of networks. I can't remember. So, but on a grid, this is how it works. So you have a focal individual here with eight neighbors, right? And in this case, the focal individual is a cooperating wild type, okay? And these yellow guys are cheating mutants. So the fitness of this focal individual, the way this model calculates it, is just 1 plus epsilon to the 6th power, okay? So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cooperating neighbors. So this guy's fitness is determined by its neighbors. So that's his fitness right there. This guy doesn't contribute because it's a cheater. Okay, so in this example, now the focal individual is a cheater, okay, and his fitness is 1 plus beta, that's his intrinsic advantage of being a cheater, times 1 plus epsilon to the 5th, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, cooperating neighbors. So that's his fitness, and the way replication and competition works is like this. So we're going to, this is now our focal individual. It's a wild type, and the first step is that it dies, and the second step is that its neighbors now vie for that space right there. They compete for that empty space, and so, and one of them wins. In this case, it's a cheater. Okay, so that's, and the one that wins, the way that's determined is it's proportional to the fitness of each, the probability of each one of the neighbors getting winning this competition is proportional to the neighbor's fitness. So for the, you have to calculate this guy's fitness, which will be, it's a cooperator, right? So you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 cooperating neighbors, so it's 1 plus beta to the 6th, okay, et cetera. You have to go around and calculate all the fitnesses of all the neighbors, and that gives you the probability that particular neighbor will invade the empty space, okay? So that's the way that works. Okay, so in mathematical terms, the way it's done analytically is that the probability that a given neighbor displaces the focal individual is the probability, first of all, that the focal individual produces no progeny, times the probability that the neighbor in question outcompetes all other neighbors of the focal individual.
Sorry, this question.
Yeah.
When you are calculating the probabilities for one particular spot to get to the center,
right?
Would not. Shouldn't you take the probability or the potential probability of that spot in the center rather than in its actual location? So if you go to the grid back, the two slides back, I think.
Sure. This one here?
Yeah. So when the central spot disappears.
Okay.
So the next spot to get to the center, the way you do it, you calculate the actual probability of each of the spots in its actual location, rather than taking it to the center and calculating its potential probability, right?
Right.
Fitness. So, wouldn't make more sense to actually calculate the probability of that spot in the center of the grid? What would it be?
Oh, I see. So once this spot moves to the center,
yes,
of the grid, what would it? Yeah.
That's what happens the next time, Steph.
Right, I guess in the next time steps, that's what it will be, so,
okay.
Yeah. But,
I think this would be...
That's a good point, yeah.
There's often a variant of those models that's used in population genetics, right, where you not have single individuals at later sites, but actually teams, which consists...
When you have metapopulations, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you would do this, then... quite relevant, because then a cooperator jumps into that spot and then he has to take over locally,
yes,
from the subpopulation.
Right, right.
And that actually will be, I guess, much harder. This is sort of an extreme spectrum of property.
Yeah. Right, right, yeah.
Which is just one guy at the flattest point.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also interesting to look at possibly beams.
Yeah. But I guess the point is well taken, because if the fitness is depending on local concentrations of resource or something, then it might be that or some average of the two that would determine it. Yeah.
Well, I can see it this way. I mean, if this is a migrant, then it has the fitness it has where it was born and grew up, and then it either migrates, then it migrates and takes its lumps in the new environment. So
right.
That also works. But I want to go back to your item one, because when you...
This one here?
Yeah, because okay. When you showed us this slide, you said the focal individual dies.
Okay, yeah.
And the next slide, you said it dies with a probability proportional to its fitness. So I'm just trying to get a handle on how fast time is running, I think.
It's all happening in one generation.
Every focal individual dies and is replaced by...
No. It's assumed that the population is being culled in the standard Wright Fisher way, so that if it's dividing by binary fission, it's going to be the zero class of the binomial distribution, where you have 0, 1, and 2 possibilities. So that's going to be the probability that it dies or goes away or something. It leaves an empty space, basically. So.
If that happens, then you go and you evaluate the 8 neighbors and pick the one that wins probabilistic.
Right, yeah.
So there'd be another way of asking some of the questions that came up is, presumably there are many versions of this process. There are many more models that you can concoct, which would be just as plausible. And hopefully the results will not be sensitive to details, right?
Yeah, hopefully. But and there are some details that I've tested its robustness to, but I haven't tested its robustness to that particular detail.
Right, so the outcome of this will be that the corporator can survive with probability close to 1, somewhere in the lattice, right?
Mm-hmm.
The statement will be that there is some regime of parameters where this is possible, right? Without
right.
Parameter tuning, so. That would be the argument for insensitivity, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
And it's probably very critically dependent on the size of this lattice. If the system is too small, then you can get into a mean field thing where the thing die out.
Yeah, you just hope that it sort of extends some e to the minus the size of the lattice.
It turns out, I'll continue talking about it, but it doesn't die out because you have recurrent mutation. So that's coming up here. So, oops. Okay, so that's the way it's modeled. We did two approaches, simulations on regular grids, both 2D, 3D, and random and scale-free networks. Also, I worked out the pair approximation solution for what it ought to be. So the results. First of all, why is the evolution of cooperation and the maintenance of cooperation, why are these two different problems? And first of all, the fixation probability of a single cooperator in a population of cheaters is greater than the fixation probability of a neutral mutation. So you can use the standard population genetics approach in that situation. But the fixation probability of a single cheater in a population of cooperators in this spatially structured population is less than the fixation probability of a neutral mutation. And it only becomes greater than that probability when you have more than one cheater mutation. Okay, when you have a number of cheater mutations that are scattered throughout the population. Okay, and that's why you really can't use the standard population genetics approach for the maintenance of cooperation. You can only use it for the evolution of cooperation. And so really what it boils down to is that you get what I'm calling a collective fixation probability instead of a single individual fixation probability. So when you have a number of cheater mutations, then it's possible for the cheaters to take over the population.
Maybe you can comment on this a bit more. What do you mean by standard population genetics approach? I mean, isn't is this
the second point more than just frequency dependent selection, or do you think something more fundamental is violated?
I'm using one particular definition of the standard population genetics approach, which is it's the invasion criteria, right? You ask, can one thing invade? And that's it's kind of the game theoretic approach more than anything. So you have a population that has a certain strategy with respect to something, right? And then you introduce one individual with a alternative strategy and ask, can that individual invade and take over the population? So it's really more the kind of evolutionary stability criteria than the standard population genetics, yeah.
Of course, when a population, when you need a certain density in order for a deterministic invasion to be possible, then you need a stochastic effect probably to get to that threshold, which is not part of standard view.
So you're saying that it could, by chance, be fixed? Is that?
I mean, in game theory, I can perfectly sort of imagine sort of the second part of your scenario, right? When the cheetahs are already like have a certain density, that then they can grow in density.
Right. Right.
And then they lose if they are too low in density.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no cheetahs. No matter what their density, have an advantage over cooperators in the meat field, in his model.
In the meat field.
Spatial model is
right, right. But it's not only cheater density, as you'll see in a minute. It has to be scattered. You have to have a certain frequency of cheaters, and they have to be scattered throughout the population.
I was just curious, where you see the problem with population genetics methods. Is it sort of in the structure, or is it
something? Yeah, I guess I'll change my terminology. It's not the population genetics method; it's the game theory method, the evolutionary stability criteria, basically.
Random mating, or not necessarily.
This is an asexual population, so there's no mating going on here. That's a good
along
point.
The same lines as Michael asked. So standard population genetics includes spatial structure, or
it could. I guess I'll call it the evolutionary stability criteria instead of the standard population genetic approach. I think that that gets around the problem. So this is the result, and that is that you have it depends on mutation, right? So cheaters are being recurrently produced in these spatially structured populations, and as long as they're produced at a low rate, cooperator frequency remains very close to one. Okay, so cooperators prevail, and cheaters cannot invade as long as they are not produced at a very high rate. But there's as their rate of mutation increases, the cooperators equilibrium frequency decreases, and you get essentially, I think, a second order phase transition at this point. And above a certain mutation rate, the cheaters prevail. And this is, I have a really smart friend who told me that if you look at cluster size, it should follow a power law right near this point here. And so I looked at it, and at least in some very small region of the of the distribution, it looks like a power line. Right? Yeah.
Isn't this phenomenon that also occurs when you have just deleterious mutations coming in? So irrespective of the fact that social evolution model, you just think about the deuterious mutation that on their own have no chance of taking over the population. If the mutation rate is too large, they will take over the population.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So it's like an that would be the standard error threshold type.
Yeah, this is in a spatial model, and actually the transition.
But here, the, okay.
There is well known physics. It's called direct calculation.
Right. Yeah.
Possibly that's what you said.
Well, I think there's a difference, and the reason I think there's a difference is because the cooperators do well in groups, right? When in clusters, when they're working together. But what's happening is when you have recurrent cheater mutation, is those clusters are being infiltrated. They're being broken up from within, and as they get broken up, they don't work as well because there are not as many of them together. So their fitness goes down.
I would be curious what's the difference between the both cases.
And yeah, yeah.
Because also if
here, I mean, but here it's really that the frequencies, not only the frequencies, but the kind of cluster morphologies and everything are having a direct effect on fitness of the individuals. So in that case, it's, you know, the fitnesses are essentially static, I think, right? I think what you're describing is the error threshold.
So if you think about your lattice, and instead of cheaters, we call them the cheaters mutations, which have a disadvantage against their neighbors, if the neighbors are the beneficial type.
Right.
If they're surrounded by other cheaters mutations, they'd be perfectly fine, because they're as good as their neighbors. So selection only acts as boundaries.
Right, right. Okay, okay. Yeah.
Mutations become too large, they start to merge.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
That's the phenomenon captured by direct calculation.
Okay.
Perhaps this translation.
Yeah. I can see how it would be related. Yeah.
Well.
Okay. I guess one difference here is that cheaters by themselves have. The best situation for a cheater is to be isolated and be surrounded by cooperators.
Right.
So, and then it only becomes deleterious as that cluster grows, right? So
that would be the boundary effect.
Right.
No, but that's the worst situation for it to be surrounded by cooperators. By the.
Yeah, it's the opposite of what I think what he's talking about is the first problem.
The problem here is that once that one cheater starts to like nucleate and get a little bubble, all along the boundary of that bubble, they have a disadvantage. So you need lots of little cheaters coming in this isolated.
Right.
Fashion.
If you think about it in terms, right. So in that situation, the newly arising clusters, the deleterious clusters, want to minimize their surface area, their surface to volume ratio, or their free energy, right? And in this case, it's the opposite. They want to maximize their surface area, okay? Because that's where they're getting their benefit. They're getting their benefit from the neighboring cooperators. So it's. Okay, so here's the analytical solution. And the way I solved it, so it boils down to, I had to use a little bit of a, to cheat a little bit and do a regression on this parameter and this parameter, but I'm not going to go into that. So it boils down to this very simple relation here that the critical mutation rate is proportional to this thing here. Alpha is the sampling exponent, so the larger it is, the more deterministic you get. Yes. Yeah. And epsilon is again, it's the amount by which cooperating neighbors increase one's fitness, and beta is the intrinsic advantage of being a cheater.
Is there a back mutation?
What's that?
Is there a back mutation?
Good question. No. We're assuming that the rate of forward mutation is much greater than the rate of back mutation. And that's essentially what has been seen in laboratory populations.
So I don't understand alpha at all. Is that like a medical?
Okay. Problem? Yeah. So that's.
I mean, you don't have to explain it, but like, what is it like?
Okay. So in this particular example, alpha is 2, because it's binary fission. because it's binary fission, so you have a...
Like local effective population?
Yeah. 1/(alpha) is like drift. Not, I mean, not exactly, sorry.
But I don't care, yeah, I don't need exact.
Yeah. Bigger alpha is like, yeah, less drift.
Right. So, yeah, I can explain it to you more detail there.
For just a minute, come on, show us the scary slide.
What's that?
Can you go back just a minute and show us the scary slide?
This one here? Okay.
What's Q naught?
That's okay.
We're going to have to.
I was afraid somebody was going to ask. I'm going to see if I can remember this. So it's a pair of proxies.
One of our ends sounds like a percolation threshold. That's what. That's
okay,
what
okay. From. Okay, so Q naught is, it's a pair approximation approach. So you have, if you're a cheater in the population, you have some probability that your neighbor will also be a cheater, right? And as the cheater frequency goes to zero, what is that probability? I think that's right. I might have it backwards. It might be cooperators.
And so what's n?
I have to go back and look. But what's that?
What's little n, the number of neighbors?
The number of neighbors, yes. Yeah. So.
It definitely feels percolation.
Does it? Yeah, yeah. Well, I got a power law. On the cluster size, so it's percolation. okay, so now if you look at cluster morphology, this gets to your point about the kind of surface to area ratio. And so this is, okay, this is actually perimeter to area ratio of the clusters. So when you're over the error, this threshold, it's large, okay? And when you're under that threshold, it's smaller. Okay, and this is cluster size. And when mutation rate is under the thresholds, the average cluster size is larger, and then it stops. It doesn't continue. And when you're over this threshold, the cluster size on average is small. What's happening there is when your mutation rate is really low, most cheater presence is due to just outgrowths of clusters, right? You have clusters forming. But when your mutation rate is high, cheater presence becomes more due to mutation, and they're isolated, right? And less due to outgrowths of clusters. Okay, and this is a slide showing the advantage of cheaters being scattered throughout the population, going back to your comment. And so what the simulations do is they start the population with three cheaters, okay, and they and this is the initial distance between those three cheaters, okay, and as you can see, as that distance grows, what I'm calling the foothold probability, which is the fixation probability in a square of 10 by 10, okay, that gives it a kind of a foothold in the population. That foothold probability grows as the distance between cheaters increases. And there's no mutation here. This is just, you're just starting with three mutations and asking, does it fix in this small square, okay? And this is, if you look at mutation rate versus the mean distance to the closest cheating neighbor, when your mutation rate is really small, again, most cheating presence is due to the growth of clusters, right? Okay, so you have a small distance between you and your cheating neighbor. As you increase this the mutation rate, more and more cheater presence becomes due to recurrent mutation. Okay, so you can have, you might have a close neighbor, but you also, it's also possible that you'll have a neighbor that's in kind of an intermediate distance. So the distance to cheating neighbors becomes larger. And this is your best situation, right? You want to have lots of distance between the cheaters. You want them as scattered as possible. So this is kind of a scattering index. So right here, that your cheaters are the farthest apart. Okay, and as you continue to increase mutation rate, of course that decreases because you have larger mutation rate, more. Okay. So if you look at what happens to cheaters in, on a global versus local scale. So if you look at it on a global scale, this again is we're above the mutation rate threshold. The relative fitness of cheaters decreases below one during most of the cheater's sojourn to fixation. Okay, so this is a evolutionary conundrum, right? That's what we call an adaptive valley. So how do you get through this adaptive valley? And this is resolved if you look at things on a local scale. So on a local scale, you start a cheater's relative fitness starts high and decreases, but it never dips below one. So it's always, on a local scale, it's always better than the cooperators. Okay? And here's cheaters. This is below the threshold, so cheaters dip down. And if you look at a local scale below the threshold, it starts. Cheaters start high, right? Because they're doing well when they're isolated. But as their frequency grows, it eventually dips below one. Okay, and that's where it stops because now it's relative to the cooperating wild type, its fitness is less. Okay, so and this it turns out so this corresponds to a game of Prisoner's Dilemma, and this corresponds to a game of chicken, which is known to control cheaters. And that's, I thought I had that slide in here, but I don't. Okay, so this is just showing how that isolated cheaters have the highest fitness, okay, because this is the highest possible fitness. In this game, that's the highest reward that you can get. Okay, as cheaters grow, their fitness declines. Now this cheater has grown to this, and its fitness is only 1 over b. So before, it went from being this, okay, having this fitness, to having this fitness here. So it took a significant decrease in fitness as that cluster grows. Okay, so now we're going to try to relate this to mutation rate. If cheater presence is mostly due to outgrowths of rare cheater mutations, then the middle of each cluster will have very low fitness. Okay, that's the tragedy of the commons, and cheater growth is contained. If cheater mutations, on the other hand, occur at a higher rate, such that there are always some isolated cheaters in the population, cheater growth will not be contained. And so you get this kind of cascading, this cascade of loss of cooperative behavior. So as neighborhoods increasingly consist of cheaters, support from neighbors decreases and it no longer pays to cooperate. As a result, neighborhoods increasingly consist of cheaters and the cycle continues. It's just kind of this positively reinforced cycle. Okay, and here's going to your question. This is how cluster morphology plays out. So if you look at cheater fitness here and take the average, you can immediately see that the average cheater fitness here, because of this guy, is going to be less than the average cheater fitness over here. And here you have exactly the same number of cheaters in this grid. It's just the cluster morphology will result in a higher cheater fitness over here than there. So, okay. Yes.
If a spot disappears and you're deciding which of the neighbors replaces it, so it matters sort of how that cheater does in that spot rather than its absolute fitness, right? But if any
yes.
has a better chance of replacing the cooperator.
Right.
So there's something I'm missing as to why this is important.
Okay, so I had a slide on this, but it's not. center here. So suppose we're on this boundary right here, and this is our focal individual, right? Okay, now his fitness is 1 plus epsilon to the 3, right? Okay, and he's competing with this guy over here, whose fitness is, if let's suppose that these are our cooperators, is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1 plus epsilon to the fifth, right? Well, this is 1 plus epsilon to the 3 times 1 plus beta, right? Okay, so this guy will, yeah, right, yeah, I mean, I see your point. I mean, you would have to go around it to really assess it. You have to go around it and average the probabilities of being displaced, right? Yeah, but if you, but it, so if you then look at the probabilities of displacement of cheaters here, yeah, I can't see. Okay, so. It will amount to an averaging over the displacement probabilities, and I can go through it afterwards. But because obviously, if you do this one, it's not going to be you're not going to get a higher probability of displacement if you take this one.
But very simple geometry, just. Half plane yellow, half plane white. And then you can ask the question about stability of the index, which way is it moving?
Right.
Probably depending on the epsilon beta, it will go either one way or the other.
So half randomly placed or
no,
or
no,
half?
Like this.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
If beta is too big, then the cheaters will win. But if it's not,
right. Yeah. So this we're using the prisoner's dilemma criteria that epsilon is greater than beta. And if that's the case, and unfortunately I had a slide showing exactly that.
That's more than enough to make the cooperators an exact answer.
Will it be interface that exists or? Very fuzzy with humans and everything. Do you have an intuition on that? If you do what he says, you start with the interface, half spaces, operators, you are in the regime. So the interface, the cheaters take over, but how do they do it? Will it be an interface that moves?
No, it's the other way. It's got to be think, because as soon as a cheater breaks the interface and starts stretching fingers in, then it has an advantage. So it's as long as they stay an interface, the cooperators win, but then it starts to break down these filaments and cheaters.
Which will appear because it all things to pass through.
Was this all done with totally filled lattice?
Yes.
Does it make any difference if you have spots?
Not much. So I also did simulations. I didn't do that. Didn't work out the analytical theory because then you have three types instead of two and it get really complicated. But I did simulations where you have vacant spots and it doesn't change things that much. You condition on non-extinction, that sort of thing, and it doesn't change the results very much.
If your lattice also grows, so
if the lattice grows, I don't know. I haven't looked at that.
Suppose you had diffusion, that is, you can just swap white and yellow.
Yes. So that's a there is a degree of diffusion allowed in this model, in the simulations, and also in the analytical theory, you can put in local diffusion, and there that has a large effect in decreasing the critical mutation rate. So as you start increasing the diffusion, then because then you're approximating the mean field situation. So. Okay, so this is an old slide. I used to call it kin selection, this idea of cooperatives helping each other. I've kind of shied away from that for various reasons. But because what do you mean by kin when you have a clonal population, right? So they're all kin. So there's kind of debate in the area of cancer, as far as I understand, over the role of immunity in cancer, and is it necessary for the immune system to constantly be surveilling and looking for cancerous mutants, or does the immune system only kick in when a tumor starts to form? And so there's so anyways, this kind of approach might inform that debate, because population structure can contain cheaters. And let's see. Okay, so we have mutation rate, and we have the evolution of cheating. Yeah.
This kind of cheating, does it have that much to do with cancer?
Yeah. So there are what they call the hallmarks of cancer, and there are 8 of them, I think. And 7 of all but one of those are cheating characteristics. And you can think of, for example, growth constraints. If you release growth constraints, that's a huge. Gives you a huge evolutionary advantage all of a sudden.
But do the cancer cells really, they do better when they're surrounded by normal cells, not by other cancer cells?
Yeah, that's a good question. They do in the sense that the normal cells are not using more than their share of the resources. They're controlling their growth. Right.
But they also do, if the tumor gets to be too big, because they don't develop normal vascularization, they depend on the vascularization of normal cells.
Right. Yeah.
But the big tumors, they get a mutation.
It's already a big tumor before that effect.
So what's the 8th characteristic?
Anybody know? Yeah. So anyways, the reason I say that is because one of the guys I had read this paper is Carlo Malley, and he's an expert on this stuff. And anyways, okay, so what happens when what happens when both things evolve? You have cheaters and cooperators evolving, and mutation rate evolving as well. So these are the model assumptions. Some mutations can affect mutation rate. You get mutators and anti-mutators, and some other mutations affect social behaviors. Okay, and make you either cheater or cooperator. And so this is the result of that model. This the x-axis is time in all cases. This is the frequency of cheaters, and as time your mutation rate is evolving. This is mutation rate. On a log scale, so this is cooperator mutation rate. This is mutation rate amongst the cheaters, and this is the fraction of the populations that have in which the largest cluster consists of cheaters. Okay, so this is that's a very sharp threshold there. And this is fitness over here. So you can see that the prisoner's dilemma is it holds, the fitness goes down in both cooperators and cheaters, and mean population fitness goes down. this has something to do with cluster size, but okay, and this is a just a movie of this is a simulation. These are cheaters arising in the population. These are just snapshots every so often of the simulations. And you can see that they grow up, but they don't quite get a foothold. The mutation rate is also evolving in this population. So there's you can see the mutation rate is increasing. And the reason we think that it's increasing, one of the reasons is that cheaters, when they're isolated, have a selective advantage, and mutators might have an indirect selective advantage because they're producing more isolated cheaters. So eventually the cheaters displace the wild type. And here's another movie of this is a 3D movie, and these are just cheaters that are they're popping up in the population. They're being displaced by cooperators, and the color indicates the mutation rate, I think. So this is a low, blue is a low mutation rate, and red is a high mutation rate. And
wait, in 3D they should have a much easier time, right? The cheaters.
What's that?
This is actually in 3D. They're living in a 3D
model. Right. Yeah.
They have a much easier time, right? Because they can spread while keeping a high surface area.
What does it do? I'm sorry.
Sure. The cheaters can grow while still keeping a large surface area with the cooperators.
More so than in a 2D, in 2D, yeah, I guess.
I would guess that the critical mutation rate would go down as you increase the number of
mutations. It does, yes. Yes, it does. So, okay, and so now the cheaters have taken over the population. So.
They haven't.
Well, they have, actually. They have, because, yeah. I'm just, one little point is representing a box, so.
But there's lots of empty boxes. The red points keep moving.
Well, yeah, they're.
It's not the same as the 2D image where it just went black.
I think I actually have back mutation. The other one didn't have back mutation, and this one does. Yeah, that's, yeah.
Is there a critical mutation rate in 1D?
That's a good question. I don't know.
The coordination, the number of neighbors in this model matters.
Yes. There should be a, because then n would be 2, basically, and I think there should be, yeah.
Like if I have an isolated cheater to colonize a neighbor site, right, it has to outcompete all the cooperating neighbors of that site.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is, so it really has to nucleate to run a larger local cluster, like surround operating site in a bit. And that actually seems to fix the peculiarity of the model.
I'm not sure.
Anyway,
yeah.
So there seems to be like a waiting time before to suddenly the cheaters take over. So. How does this scale with system size? Is it more difficult to take over larger systems, or is it just completely the same?
I think so. It should happen. It should actually happen quicker in the higher your dimensionality. That's one answer. I don't know about system size.
If you just make the system 10 times as big, would it?
It shouldn't. I don't think it should matter, because what it's really dependent on is the recurrent mutation throughout that population. It's not one. Again, it's not one cheater mutation invading the population. It's recurring throughout that population, and it'll do so in a similar way in a large population. So. Yeah. Okay, so this is a summary of the findings. First of all, the premises are that cheaters appear by mutation in a population of cooperators. The population has structure. So the main finding is that cheater growth is contained below a mutation rate threshold and no fancy mechanisms are required.
I actually think your main finding is the kind of converse. I mean, that was known, right? Like here, there's all kinds of prisoner's dilemma on the lattice.
Oh, right, right.
Where they just kind of ignored mutation. Your point is that you can't always do that if the mutation rate is too high.
Right, right. Yeah, so below a threshold, yeah.
Right, so you're actually
trying to implying that it's
threshold.
Not contained. Yeah, implying that it's not contained above that threshold. Okay, so appealing to Occam's razor here, if population structure is the simplest explanation for cheetah control, could population structure be the predominant form of cheetah control? You know, there's. And then the applications to cancer, which is what I'm talking with this guy, Carl O'Malley, about. Do we have a model that could maybe be a cancer model someday, given that most. Most precancerous mutations are have cheating characteristics, and so maybe it's and so there's evidence that for cancers backwards social evolution, right? That this cheating, and there's also evidence for mutators that are associated with many cancers. So our model would suggest that maybe it's not. One or the other, but kind of the interplay between these two that gives rise to a transition. And I think that's it. So, and then again, I already mentioned this. That's it. So, and I should have Carlo in here too. Carlo Malley is somewhere here in California. He just moved. He was at he was in Pennsylvania. So that's it. Oh, Claudia did most of the simulation work, so she's... Yes?
So in your mutation threshold, you did not include dimensionality. How would that enter?
In the mutation rate threshold?
Yes. I think there was only alpha, beta, and epsilon in there, right?
Yes. And it doesn't... I was afraid this would come out, because I don't... And it doesn't depend on N, on the number of neighbors. Which is, I think, what a question over here was getting at.
I thought you hinted down that the threshold is lower in three dimensions than in two.
Yeah. And I'm not, actually, I'm not sure that that's true now that I think about it. There are two opposing things that turn. It turns out they cancel each other out, and so one is that. Oh boy. I'll try to remember it. It's in the discussion of the paper, which. there are two opposing factors that ultimately cancel each other out, and so that it turns out that formula doesn't. That was one of the big surprises of this, of working out the theory, is that the critical mutation rate doesn't depend on the number of neighbors, and it turned and actually so in the simulations, what that translates to is when I did it on the different with different network topologies, it was fairly insensitive to the network topologies.
With the advantage of their cooperators, the kind of interface increases in the number of neighbors because we've got more of their other cooperators to support them.
Right. Yeah.
That's one way increasing the number of neighbors helps the cooperators.
That would help the cooperators, but it also helps isolated cheaters.
Right. Are those the factors that cancel, or do
I'm not sure. Yeah.
So I can imagine that in a population where most of the individuals are cheaters, the average fitness per individual is much lower than in a population where all are cooperators, right? Not saying that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm just saying that.
So that's the that's the standard.
So basically, a population with lots of cheaters has less probability of persisting. Unless mutation rates
computational rate also evolves.
Yeah, right. And that's actually the that actually has been observed in laboratory populations. That's the example that I alluded to in Myxococcus, they had cheaters took over the population went extinct. Yeah.
So could you introduce in your models actually the evolution of the mutation rate itself?
That's what those latter simulations do. Yeah, the last model that I showed, those simulations where the you have the dots appearing, those mutation rate is also evolving in those populations.
Right, toward cheaters. I mean, you could have reverse mutations from cheaters to cooperators.
Right, right.
So introducing that, you might get to an equilibrium in the frequency of cheaters and cooperators in your population.
Yeah, yeah. So the experimental evidence suggests that the rate of mutation from cooperators to cheaters is quite high, and that the reverse is low.
Yeah, but and that's so because that, the frequency of cooperators is high, right?
No, per individual mutation rate.
Yeah, but I mean,
there's a whole lot of things you can break in cooperation to become a cheater, right? Lots of mutations to these cooperator genes turn you a cheater. But
yeah,
to go the other way, you have to get that exact back mutation to cancel.
Yeah, I see that, but I mean, looking in global terms, mm-hmm. the probability of reverse mutation, so from cheater to cooperator, is much higher if the number of cheaters is much higher in the population as well.
The total number is, yeah, right. But the per replication number is not, yeah. Yeah.
So going back to something you said about the diffusion rate, wouldn't a second mutation that caused the cheaters to either diffuse more or just avoid each other be beneficial and potentially get rid of the whole critical mutation rate?
If that were a possibility, yeah. And that's not in this model. This is the diffusion rate is set in the model.
Right.
Yeah, right. That doesn't need to be. Yes?
Basically, I think it's reasonable to assume that the third allele would arise, which is not playing as well as cheater, when you read the computer open and you get from cooperator, but somehow slightly deleterious allele, and then you know, basically some.
You mean another mutation if you
have a mutator, you have a higher.
That's a really good. Yeah, that's a really good point, and that's that has been implemented in further work on this. And obviously, there's some fraction of deleterious mutations that will contain cheaters under all conditions.
Right.
So yeah. Or some fraction or some strength of, I can't remember which one. But yeah, there is a parameter range with respect to deleterious mutations that will actually contain the cheaters. Because what happens is the cheaters are being associated with the mutators, right? Because they're advantageous when they're rare, and so, yeah. Any other questions? Let's go for coffee.